This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Memory, imagination, language, music. These things make us human. For centuries, they've been considered mystical, and still our understanding of how these functions arise from the electrical activity of the brain remains relatively rudimentary. But there is a growing sense among those who study the brain that we are poised to make major inroads into the mysteries of the human brain this century. In 2013, President Obama announced the launch of a 15-year, $100 million initiative to develop technologies that would enable researchers to map the electrical activity of the entire human brain. It's an endeavor that Obama and others have likened to the Human Genome Project, or even the space program of the 1960s. The Brain Initiative grew out of an idea first proposed by Dr. Rafael Yusta, a professor of neuroscience at Columbia University. His own research is motivated by a passionate desire to understand the underpinnings of debilitating neurodegenerative diseases and mental health conditions like schizophrenia. His experiences as a young doctor drove him to leave his home country of Spain and launch a new career in neurobiology research. Earlier this year, he co-authored an article in Scientific American proclaiming this the new century of the brain. Rafael Yusta, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Earlier this year, you wrote a piece for Scientific American with George Church, a major player in the Human Genome Project, in which the two of you declared that we are now in the new century of the brain. Why?
There is a historic moment in science in which, for the first time, mankind is trying to understand how the brain works. And this is historic because humans are mental animals, and all of our mind is generated by the brain. So science is going to come to the opportunity to understand what makes us human. We're going to be able to understand ourselves from the inside for the first time. So many of us think that this is going to be a turning point in history. It's going to be a cultural revolution that will be a before and after. Because up until now, humans have made great progress in many realms of science, in medicine. We understand many parts of the body. We can cure many diseases. Yet, when you get to the nose and reach up the brain, it's pretty uncharted territories. No, I mean, it's fair to say that we don't understand how the brain works. An example of this is that in medicine, we cannot really cure mental diseases or most neurological diseases, even though they're devastating and they affect a significant proportion of mankind. We treat those patients, in spite of the heroic efforts of psychiatrists and neurologists, with treatments that that take away some of the symptoms without attacking the cause, the problem. So it's a little bit like what used to happen in other parts of medicine, let's say in infectious diseases, when we didn't know that there were bacteria around. So it's this bad. No? We have this problem with the brain that we don't have a general theory, therefore we cannot cure these diseases. But again, more generally, the brain makes us what we are. No?
So, okay, so you said general theory. What would a general theory, I mean, you know, physicists have been searching for the unifying theory for decades. What would a general theory of the brain be trying to explain?
Yeah. So I think what we need is to, okay, let me put it this way. So we know from 100 years of work with neurological patients and animal work that all the mental abilities of humans and the higher cognitive function of animals are all based on the brain. So this is not black magic. They are emerged from the skull, inside the skull, and if you look in there, it's just a bunch of neurons firing. So there has to be a way by which the firing of these neurons generate the mental states and generate the behavior.
This is getting into the realm of religion in a lot of cases, this idea that there is something inexplicable about our brains that makes what is essentially a bunch of electrical circuits create consciousness and personality.
Yep.
Do you think there's anything inexplicable there, or do you think you really think that within this century we will understand fully how that happens?
I think there is no magic. I think this is a physical system, just like any other part of the body, and medicine has been successful explaining more and more complicated parts of the body. So why would the brain be any different? I think it's a product of evolution, and the scientific method has been effective before. Why shouldn't it be effective now? I don't think there's any reason to doubt that sooner or later mankind will reach success and will meet the challenge.
Now, in scientific terms, sometimes when we have something that's like a physical system, like electrical circuits, that comes together and create something that is more than just an electrical circuit, we would call that an emergent property.
Yeah.
Talk about the phenomenon of emergence and how you see that playing out in the brain.
I think this is exactly the problem that we have in neuroscience right now, and we've had for the last 100 years. And that's the reason, I would argue, that why we still don't have a general theory of how the brain works. So by general theory, I'm convinced it has to be something relatively simple, just like the double helix was a very simple model for inheritance, for genetics. It's got to be something like that that would explain what the brain does. But as you're pointing out, if you have a system built out of many interacting particles, you can create something together that it doesn't exist in the individual particles. So let me just give you a very simple example. So just imagine that you're at home in the evening watching TV, watching a movie. Imagine that you can only see one pixel in the screen, a couple of pixels on the screen. So no matter how long you watch, you will never figure out what the movie is about. You will never get the plot. So I think neuroscientists have been approaching the brain as a system of individual neurons and have been spending a lot of their time studying what single neurons do. But in that sense, they've been looking at one neuron in one animal or one patient and comparing that, the firing pattern of the neuron, with another neuron from another animal or another patient. And in a way, no one has been able to actually watch the whole screen. It's like we've just been limiting our measurements and our theories to the responses of individual cells. And it's obvious that the brain, any brain circuit in all animals, is made out of interacting neurons that are connected between themselves in large numbers. So this just smells for all in the world like an emergent system, like a system that has been designed by evolution to generate states of function by interaction between neurons. So that was the reason that we proposed this large-scale scientific project that we call the Brain Activity Map. And this is a proposal that we made to the White House to launch a series of technology development programs to provide neuroscientists and clinicians with the tools to be able to measure the activity of entire brain circuits. In other words, we wanted to provide the tools, the experimental methods, so that someone down the line would be able to watch the full screen, so to speak.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Dr. Rafael Yusta, professor of neuroscience at Columbia University and a key proponent of President Obama's 15-year, $100 million brain initiative. We're going to talk more about the brain activity map in a minute, but I want to go back to the single neurons first. Obviously, we're going to have to look at the interactions and look at some of the larger scales in the brain. But first, it would seem necessary that we do really understand those individual neurons, that we do understand things at that single cell level. Do we have enough of an understanding at that level to start looking at the interactions and really make sense of it?
It's hard to answer that question because we don't really know what we're missing yet. No? But I think neuroscience has been at it for just about 100 years looking at single cells, and we have a pretty good description of different cell types in different parts of the brain and how individually they function and what are the biophysical properties that they have and molecular and cellular biological aspects. So I think it's possible that we're missing something big there, but my gut feeling is that we have that pretty much under the belt. No? And then the challenge in neuroscience is something that you call the circuit problem. No? How do these cells interact? How do these neurons connect and form something together that doesn't exist in the individual ones.
Now, and as I understand it, you do have perhaps some idea of how that might be working. You've compared the cortex, the brain matter, in functioning to a Turing machine. So explain what a Turing machine is and how you think that could be a model for the brain.
Okay. Yeah, this is now all speculation because there's really, again, we lack the data because we lack the tools. We don't have the tools to be able to make these assertions effectively. No, but the hypothesis is that one part of the brain, which is the cerebral cortex, which is actually the largest part of the brain in mammals, and that's specifically where most the mental abilities lie in humans. So that's essentially what makes us human, is the cerebral cortex. So it turns out that the cortex has this very interesting property that it's very homogeneous across different cortical areas and across different mammals, different animals. Yet it appears to different parts of the cortex, and we know this from patient studies, are involved in apparently completely different computations. For instance, the visual cortex in the back of the occipital lobe is performing some sort of visual discrimination and visual perception of the world. But then the same tissue, the same cerebral cortex, if you go to the front of it, it's involved in something completely different. In the prefrontal cortex is probably calculating some probabilities about future events. Other parts of the cortex are involved in precise movement control or in deciphering speech. So all these things have apparently nothing in common. So then the hypothesis has been around by now several decades that evolution may have found in the cerebral cortex some sort of universal computational trick that can be used to solve any computation that can be solved.
I mean, is this like the computers that we have sitting on our desks? It's one computer, it's one operating system, but you know, the same hardware, but running different software to do things like movies or writing a paper or something like that.
It would be an analogous to this. In fact, and that's why we use the term Turing machine. So Alan Turing, this British mathematician, he postulated that using a digital calculus in a computer, if you gave the computer enough time, would essentially solve and crack any problem that can be solved. There's some problems that cannot be computed, but the ones that can be computed, the Turing machine would be able to do it. And that that was the intellectual foundation of the digital revolution and the computer revolution. So all the modern computers that we have are essentially children intellectually of the idea of the Turing machine. So,
And you're saying now that the brain, that our understanding essentially of the brain could also be.
The cerebral cortex, which is only one part of the brain, but the cerebral cortex could be a biological equivalent to that. It smells as if evolution has somehow hit on that trick. And then if you look at how the cerebral cortex has evolved, it's actually a very recent discovery of evolution, and it's grown in size tremendously to the point that the cerebral cortex in human is so big that it's crumbled up inside our skulls. So we cannot fit anymore. It's like evolution is trying to push as much cerebral cortex into our brains as we can take. And it's not surprising that the species like us that have such large cerebral cortex are the more cognitive and mentally able species. So this could actually explain the success not just of humans in evolution, but the success of the entire mammalian lineage, because the mammals are the branch of evolution that has the cerebral cortex. So it's really that's the kind of thing that keeps me up at night, these kinds of thoughts, because if this is the case, if we understood how the cerebral cortex work, again, that I said this would be historic, because we will be able to understand how a natural Turing machine sort of computes, and that could have great repercussions not just for our culture but even for our technology. We may be able to build computers that are much better than the computers that we have right now. It will provide a new foundation for entire new technology, and this is why your church and I titled our article "The New Century of the Brain," because if mankind had access to this knowledge, it would be revolutionary. It would change our technology. It would change also the rules by which we treat ourselves, our culture, our laws. We will be able to actually discern, in the case of criminal activities, what is the meaning of someone being guilty or not, or having had an impulse to commit a crime, we will be able to understand the logic underneath it. No, I think this will have wide repercussions.
I think there's no doubt that that kind of understanding would have wide repercussions, and some of them could be beautiful and wonderful things, curing diseases, understanding people better. But there could be a flip side to that could be scary and dangerous, don't you think?
Yes. We're actually, we're scientists, but we're also hope to be responsible citizens. So when we made this proposal, this brain activity map proposal to the White House, we made sure to link this proposal with the idea that this technology is going to be so powerful that it has to be under public control, under control of the public, and it should be supervised, the development of this technology, by ethical panels. And this will be panels a little bit analogous to what Philip Kitcher had proposed before for science. These are panels where representatives not just of scientists, but also of the society, of the citizenship, and essentially with wide representations of all parts of society, could be involved in ethical regulation and control of how this technology gets developed. I'm actually confident mankind has been able to develop revolutionary technologies in the past, and although there are some instances when they've gone astray, but there's also, I would say, a positive lesson from history that things like nuclear technology or biological warfare has been under relatively good control by different societies over the last century, at least. So we hope that this technology, if we do it right, and from the beginning, if it's a public effort run by the public and overseen by the public, it will be put to good use and will not have, or hopefully will minimize these potential dangers.
I'm talking with Dr. Rafael Yusta, professor of neuroscience at Columbia University. We'll talk more about the Brain Initiative. That's after a short break. Stay with us. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Rafael Yusta of Columbia University. His dream of being able to simultaneously map the electrical activity of every neuron in the human brain is what developed into a 15-year, $100 million brain initiative announced last year by President Obama. Let's go back to the very beginning of the brain, what is now the Brain Initiative, this brain activity map proposal. It came about during a brainstorming session with several dozen scientists, neuroscientists, also physicists and engineers. Tell us about that meeting. Where did that brainstorming session come from, and what was the result?
Yeah, so this all starts in September of 2011 at a country house in England, where there's a meeting of about 25 scientists that are drawn from neuroscience, but also from the physical sciences and genomics. And the purpose of the meeting is to brainstorm about the future of neuroscience and essentially tackling this issue that we were just discussing earlier.
Is this something that the field of neuroscience does on a regular basis, or was there a sense that there was some crisis or turning point to prompt this kind of brainstorming?
I think there is the feeling in the air that there's a turning point in neuroscience and we're ready for a new approach. And also a little bit, another way to look at this is that neuroscience has grown out of its old clothes. It's like a kid that's grown. And original neuroscience used to be like small science, man, pastor type of science. And now it's just involving thousands of people across the world with billion-dollar budgets. And it's becoming a full mature science like physics and chemistry and engineering and astronomy, for example. So many of us had this feeling, and I came to that meeting with that idea that maybe it's about time that neuroscientists start working together as opposed to work individually. We all run our little labs, but we don't work in teams of people tackling hard problems because we all think, oh, this is just the problem is too hard for individual labs. So, stimulated by the example of the human genome, we proposed the idea, that neuroscience could maybe start to get our act together and team up and try to develop these tools that are absolutely necessary if someone wants to actually look at the complete pattern of activity of neurons across entire brain circuits. So this was the origin of the proposal. And so in this brainstorming meeting, it's also a beautiful example of the old German saying that the Gedanken sind frei, the ideas are free, because once the idea was proposed, it started taking a life on its own. Many people jump in and made the contribution to the idea, and we ended up generating a series of white papers and publications, and we send them to different organizations in the U.S. and abroad that have to do with the funding of science and the direction of scientific programming. And one of these white papers went to the Office of Science and Technology of the White House, OSTP, who independently were looking for large-scale stimulating projects that could be used as a banner to get society excited about scientific progress.
I mean, this is like the moon mission or
exactly.
the space program.
Exactly, like the space program, the moon mission, closer to our times, the Human Genome Project or the National Nanotechnology Initiative. So our proposal entered the White House OSTP exactly at the time where they were starting to think big. I said, okay, what is it that we can do to make a difference? And I have to tell you that in our interactions with OSTP, I was blown away by their professionality and also by their broad vision. They wanted to do something that's historic, that people later will look back at our generation and said, oh, these are the generation that figure out how the brain works. Just like we look admiringly at the generation before us, these are the people that put the man on the moon. So they were broad thinkers. And we just proposed this ambitious plan.
Exactly was the proposal that came out of that brainstorming session?
The proposal was a 15-year project involving hundreds of labs across the country and around the world, a little bit similar to what happened to the Human Genome Project, where a mixture of neuroscientists with physical scientists, people coming from physics, engineering, chemistry, computational approaches would jointly develop tools, methods to measure the activity of entire brain circuits and to alter the activity of entire brain circuits.
So this is not just, as you said it earlier, seeing all of the pixels, seeing the whole movie, but being able to edit that movie
exactly.
in real time.
Exactly. The way we put it, it's to read and write activity.
Back to that computer analogy.
Exactly. So it is. It's also. I mean, scientists are a little bit childish sometimes. We like to have fun and play around. And for us intellectually, it's very stimulating to think of the possibility of not just reading out the activity of a brain circuit, but to be able to go in and interfere with it. And you say, well, why would you want to do that? Well, let me just tell you a very, very precise reason. So actually, my original training is in medicine. And one of the reasons why I decided to go into neuroscience and actually come to Woods Hole to take a neurobiology course at the Marine Biological Laboratory is because I was rotating in the psychiatry wards in my native Madrid when they put us to handle a paranoid schizophrenic patients, which are extremely dangerous. They were essentially jailed up, and we had to interview them with a bodyguard. And these are among the smartest people I've ever met. These are brilliant minds. They're people that, a little bit like Sherlock Holmes, could perceive and deduce almost anything from the information they receive, except that they turn it against you. And they threaten you with threats that really got under your skin. And I just had this feeling of impotency. I said, gosh, these people have some beautiful brains. If we can only tweak whatever is wrong in them, if there's a little switch somewhere in their cerebral cortex, we can just turn that switch. They not only sort of avoid this trail of devastation that they leave behind in their in society, in their families, and in themselves, but be able to be among the most productive and fruitful contributors to society. You know? So I was just convinced that we're not going to be able to treat these patients properly until we can actually get in there, map the circuits, and there has to be some particular part of the brain that is misfiring and fix it. A little bit like you would fix a car, go in there and just change that switch. So that's a little bit part of my personal motivation why I went into neuroscience. And that's why we need to develop tools, not just to watch and diagnose what's wrong with this patient, but to be able to go in them and cure them.
Now, the actual brain initiative, it, at least initially, is not so much about actually doing that mapping of brain activity. It's about actually developing the tools that we would need to do that, because we don't even have that technology
exactly.
yet. We're not even there.
Yeah. So we just have to be sensible. There's no way we're going to be able to understand how the brain works and to cure these schizophrenic patients until we have the tools to do that. And we don't have the tools today. So this is just like building a house.
Do we even know what kinds of tools we would need?
Yes. Well, we know what we need to do. We don't know how. Okay. So I think we need to be able to be more specific, to track the activity of entire neural circuits with single cell resolution. You have to be able to see the individual neurons firing and do that over a very fast frames times, about once per millisecond at least.
And we're talking about close to 100 billion neurons in the human brain.
That would be the entire human brain. And that, I think, it's maybe a little bit too much for now. No, but I'm much more, I think more realistically is to try to measure the activity of all the neurons in the brain of a small animal, let's say in a worm or a fly or a zebrafish, or a piece of the brain of a mammal or a piece of the brain of a human patient. So let's say a epileptic patient. So they're routinely in every hospital in the country. Epileptic patients that have epilepsy that don't respond to drugs, they're treated by neurosurgery. So in these patients, you have the skull open, you can actually see a piece of the cerebral cortex that's going to be taken out, and you could imagine monitoring the activity of every neuron in that little piece of the brain and trying to use that information to actually understand how epilepsy works or what is wrong with epileptic circuits and be able to actually come up with strategies to fix it.
Now, we've used this word activity a few times. Are you literally talking about just an electrical pulse, that electrical activity, or are there different levels on which you could monitor activity of a neuron?
Yeah, there are different levels, yet I think it's fair to say that the brain is just a collection of neurons that are firing electrical impulses and carrying those electrical impulses from one neuron to the next. No? So as a first approximation, if you capture all the electrical activity of the brain, you would have access to all the information that you may need to figure it out. So that's a little bit the analogy with the human genome. So our proposal was that we wanted to measure every spike from every neuron, which is sort of analogous to be able to sequence every nucleotide from the genome. So once you do that, you're finished. It's like there's no more neurons. That's it. You've got every neuron and you got every spike. Again, we're not talking about doing that to the whole human brain, the 100 billion neurons, but imagine doing that in a small animal while you monitor the behavior of the animal, and you can use that to understand how the circuits work. And I was telling you earlier that the cerebral cortex is actually conserved in evolution across all mammals. So maybe if we understand how a little piece of the cerebral cortex in a mouse work, we may be able to understand what's wrong with these schizophrenics.
The space project, the human genome, any of these big ideas, in addition to inspiring a lot of people, are always going to encounter a lot of pushback, not necessarily even because of the repercussions or ramifications of understanding the brain in this case, but just a simple, that's not possible kind of pushback. How much of that have you experienced from even those in your own field, in neurobiology?
Oh, a lot. I can tell you that you need a thick skin if you want to stand out there and make one of these bold proposals, because you get shot at from all angles with arrows. They say I've experienced this firsthand. Even in this meeting in England, as soon as I proposed this idea, there was a whole range of very strong criticisms from neuroscientists. And it was actually George Church, one of the pioneers of the Human Genome Project, who happened to be sitting next to me, who stood up and said, "Wait a minute. The criticisms were that, okay, it's impossible. You cannot measure a reaction potential from every neuron. Even if you could do it, it would be too expensive. Even if you had the money, it would be too much data and you wouldn't know what to do with the data. And your church stood up and said, guys, this is exactly the same criticisms that were made against the Human Genome Project at the beginning, and they were wrong.
I mean, do you think that the Human Genome Project has proved that it was successful and worthwhile at this point?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, not only the Human Genome Project was successful, they finished ahead of schedule. And to everyone's surprise, this investment of money in the Human Genome Project to develop these tools has created an enormous industry with gigantic economic windfall. It's been estimated by the Battelle Foundation that for every dollar that the U.S. government invested in the Human Genome Project, the economy 15 years later got $140 back. This argument did not escape us and was part of the proposal that we made to the White House.
That would have to be attractive to the federal government. And,
exactly.
And particularly President Obama has repeatedly made the case to the country that we need to become a science and technology economy.
Yes. In fact, that was actually the line of our proposal that the same words were ushered by President Obama during the State of the Union address last year. And at that point, we didn't know that they had chosen our proposal as a large-scale scientific project. We were just watching TV like everyone in the country, listening to the president of the State of the Union address, and we fell off our chair when we heard that he was proposing develop tools to map the brain and solve these brain diseases.
So you got no advance notice of this?
None at all. We worked with the White House over a period of a year and a half. We went to Washington a few times. We met with them. We increased the team of people on our side. Proposal became much richer and more with much more detail and very programmatic. But we knew that the White House was considering other types of proposal in different fields of science and technology. They were just looking very broadly. So we didn't really know that they had chosen us until we heard President Obama speak. And the argument he made to Congress is exactly the argument you made, that said, hey guys, if we want the U.S. to keep on top of things economically, we better develop new technologies, because this is what happened with genomics. No, the genomics is now the center of the genomics revolution is in the U.S. because of the Human Genome Project. So let's plant the seeds now, today, for the future of neurotechnology, so that 10, 15 years from now, we will create, and I honestly think this is going to be even bigger than genomics, because as I was telling you earlier, we're now dealing not just with some aspects of our body, we're dealing with the heart of our minds and our culture, the intersection between science and our minds and our civilization. So it's got to be a much, it's got to have a much bigger impact for the economy and for society. So I think that was the argument that he made to Congress. My understanding, at least from, I'm a little bit of an outsider, because once we made the proposal and the White House endorse it, they took it over, they changed the name, and they essentially have just gone on to implement it. And we've been kept essentially outside as we should, because it would be a conflict of interest. The people involved in launching that proposal are the people involved in running the proposal. It's two completely different jobs. So the way that it's developed, I think it's gathered, as far as I can tell, bipartisan support, because it's perceived by Congress, as it is as by many parts of society and foundations and federal agencies, as something so fundamental.
Everybody has a brain.
Yeah, everyone has a brain. Everyone has patients that suffer from mental disease, neurological diseases. This is getting worse as the population is aging, and we just have to do something about it. We cannot just sit here and wait for a lucky break. We have to take arms, and just like we did in as a society before, and we were able to meet these big challenges of sequencing the human genome, figuring out the structure of matter, sending a man to the moon, understanding cancer. I mean, when I went to medical school, Most of the cancers were not cured. Now most of the cancers actually are cured. I mean, this is tremendous progress over a lifespan. So why should the brain be different?
I'm talking with Dr. Rafael Yusta, professor of neuroscience at Columbia University. We'll talk more about the Brain Initiative and also the role of dreaming and creativity in science. That's after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is Dr. Rafael Yusta of Columbia University. We're talking about his efforts to unlock the secrets of the human brain by mapping the electrical activity of large numbers of individual neurons.
Do you think there will be one brain activity map, or would every single person have a potentially a different brain activity map?
Yeah, I think if we imagine the thought experiment of monitoring the activity of every neuron in the brain of a human, what I would expect is that there would be some common features in the same person. So the brain activity map would be changing continuously. In fact, that probably reflects the way our mind works, that is always a fluid structure. It would not settle down. But there would be some commonalities that would probably define who we are, personality, and there would be some similarities from person to person that would define essentially what we call a person. So, and then there would be also some similarities when you compare people with animals.
It's those large-scale similarities, the commonalities that you would be looking for.
I'm convinced there's not going to be any magic there. It's just going to be another case of a physical system or biological system, and it's going to have layers of complexity, and at the bottom of which is going to be something very simple that is very common, and this would be what we were calling earlier the general theory of how the brain works. Is there a simple way that you can describe what brains do across all animals, in not just all humans, but all animals? And then on top of that, you'll see some features of this activity that will be specific maybe to some species or specific to some individuals, and that defines the individuality that we recognize in our culture.
How critical is federal government support for a large-scale effort like this? Is there any other way that you could do something as big as a brain activity map?
I think it's absolutely critical. This is the time. This is what we have leaders. This is what politicians, this is their job. They should be carrying the flag for society and helping bring society to the future, to the cutting edge of the technology and the science. Because you could wait for things to happen, but they have to be crystallized by the government. I think these projects are very large, and as we were saying earlier, this technology is also potentially could get out of hand. So it has to be run by the public. There's no way around it. This is too important to leave in private hands. We're dealing with the essence of our minds and with the essence of the rules by which we treat ourselves. This has to be a public effort, and who better to lead this than our public leaders, you know, the people that have been elected by the majority of the citizens who have the trust of the people.
Now, you have said before that science, there's a side of science that is business, and that's kind of the ability to generate science and technology that can create jobs and drive an economy. But then there's another side of science that you say is a calling and is about dreaming. What does science and your research mean to you personally?
Yeah, so I'm much more on the dreamer, poorer side of science. We joke that I have an MD PhD, and my wife tells me that the more letters you have after your name, the fewer the less money you make. MD PhDs make less money than MDs. And there's a study also at Caltech that the people that were more successful financially, the ones who drop out of college, so if you don't get a BA, you even make more money than if you do. Anyway, so jokes aside.
Joking aside, that seems to go against a lot of arguments for higher education.
Yeah. We're in the business of helping mankind, and that's actually why I became a doctor and I became a scientist, and do that in a way in which we make push forward progress in science, and we can have an impact, maybe not today around us, but maybe in the future, future generations across the globe. No, I think to me, science is just a beautiful calling, because You get to help mankind in a very pure fashion by exercising your creativity and your freedom of thinking. No, I think it's a little bit, I compare this also like mountain climbing. Mountain climbers also, they go out there by themselves with their small teams of people to do something completely incredible, which appears completely useless. Yet they sort of the dreamers that push our boundaries as a society as to tackle these major challenges. So for me, the understanding how the brain works is just one of these big challenges, another mountain to climb that as a society we have to do. And I understand that once we get there, then there will be a lot of economic windfall for society. And I think this is the way it should be. And I think it's good that society incorporates this knowledge. This is actually how progress works. It's always like that. There's always a scientist at the front of the progress in society. You will always find scientists, engineers, and maybe I would put in that cohort also the artists, because they also push the boundaries of mental boundaries of mankind, artists and musicians and writers. And then later comes the economy that incorporates all of that new ground into the life, and then it becomes it's digested and it sort of pushes the whole society forward.
You've also said that like many other callings, science can involve personal sacrifice. Do you feel that you have made sacrifices for your science?
Absolutely. I mean, I came to this country with two suitcases, leaving behind my family, my friends, potentially profitable careers in MD, and start from scratch to get on with the program, try to get trained at the best laboratories, including the Marine Biological Laboratory here.
How good does it feel to be back teaching now the course that helped launch you on your career in neurobiology?
I cannot tell you how rewarding it is to be invited back by the MBL to teach a new generation of scientists. A little bit like passing the torch, you know? Just like I was taught by people who were visionaries and inspired me to do this with my life. No, I think it's my responsibility to bring back that torch that I was given and pass it on. I try to pass it on to the younger minds that we have here that come from all over the country, all over the world, so that because it's their responsibility. Maybe it's them who are going to be figuring out how the brain works. We're going to help them get them the right tools, but we may not be able to do it ourselves. But it's the next generation. I mean, you know, in science, you stand on the shoulders of the previous generation. And that's another something that's very beautiful in science. It's an enterprise that carries along in space across all countries and also across times. You know? So we read articles of people that are long dead as if they were sitting next to us. You know? Have mental dialogues with people of other times. So I think it's just a wonderful thing to do this in a very pure fashion where there's no money involved. And the ultimate goal is to help mankind.
On a lighter note, your group at Columbia University holds 7 different patents, 6 of which clearly seem to be related to neurobiology, and one of which is for analyzing financial market data.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's pretty, yeah, this is pretty funny. It also shows you how all these things in science are related. So we were just cracking our heads trying to figure out for good algorithms to decipher how neurons fire together, to try to capture these emergent properties of brain function. And anyway, so just write up these algorithms, and we have a very active patent office. Every time we come up with something new, we just send it to the patent office, and they look at it, and they decide whether they want to patent or not. Anyway, so turns out that the mathematics that we use for deciphering brain patterns could be used to decipher the stock market. Okay, so I don't have any particular interest in the stock market, but Columbia University decided that, hey, let's just patent this because it could actually lead to some future stock market algorithms. So funny enough, we patented the algorithms, and then we had a few visitors from Wall Street who were very sophisticated traders studying derivatives who used our software to try to make some predictions as to the past performance of the stock market. And it was very interesting. It didn't lead to any licensing, but it was definitely a lot of fun. No? And this also, I mean, the more serious part about this is that the mathematical problems that we may have to tackle to understand how the brain works are actually very similar to the type of mathematical problems that people are using to try to decipher, for instance, the stock market. So
we really have no idea what might come out of a brain activity map if you can analyze the stock market from one algorithm.
Yeah. Well, I think we just need better algorithms, and we need to have an effort in tools that are also not just experimental tools to get more data, but also computational tools, new mathematics to try to analyze complex systems. And these have impact in stock market, in brain activity, in the weather forecast. I mean, these are just fundamental questions that affect all of science and technology. No?
Rafael Yusta, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Dr. Rafael Yusta is a professor of neuroscience at Columbia University, where he's working to map the electrical activity of the human brain. If there's one thing we've learned about the brain in recent years, it's that functions like logic and creativity aren't as distinct as we once thought. We've seen this reflected in the rising popularity of art-science collaborations in recent years. For example, oceanographer Larry Pratt has been working with choreographer Courtney Pikes to create a dance piece inspired by ocean science.
I try not to be too literal with it, although there are certain times where it feels very appropriate to just be very literal. If I want to create a sense of a wave or a sense of turbulence, maybe I just literally start being very particular about what is turbulence, what is a wave, how am I going to physically interpret it. But inevitably, I end up sculpting the piece, and it starts to change and develop, and then you start to get sort of that emotional aspect and that human aspect into the piece.
Larry, I'm curious, what do you see when you watch these dance pieces? Do you see oceanographic processes?
I see what I sort of like to see in the art that I enjoy, which is I see glimpses of things, and I see maybe abstractions that maybe have different interpretations that give me some idea of I'm looking at some kind of process in the ocean or maybe just in a fluid in general, but I can attach different meanings to it and maybe see it differently each time I look at it.
The dancing is set to a score that's based on recordings of underwater sounds.
You hear the sounds of other boats, other engines, and so you try to go to places where you're away from that a little bit. There's very interesting sounds just from the flow of water going over a bed or over a kind of a grassy bed. And sometimes you hear sounds that we think are made by fish, sort of croaking sounds.
Composer Amber Vistein uses a complex technical process to translate those sounds into music.
Amber's taken some of the marine mammal sounds from the Hui archives, and she's basically convolved those with the sounds of instruments. So basically what she's done is she's sort of combined the common elements in, say, a sound that's made by a humpback whale with the sort of the frequency content of a cello.
For our full conversation with Larry Pratt and Courtney Pikes, visit our website, capeendislands.org. You'll find Living Lab in the programs menu. You can also follow Living Lab Radio on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.